Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Wednesday the 3rd of April, these are our main stories. Israel is under increasing international pressure to investigate its strike, which killed 7 aid workers in Gaza. Rescue workers in Taiwan try to free motorists trapped in road tunnels by a powerful earthquake. Also in this podcast, the top appeals court in Uganda upholds a controversial anti-homosexuality law considered one of the toughest in the world. And in France, shared grief is leading to shared healing at an orphanage for the children of police officers.
My dad was my hero, but he never spoke about his job. I came here a month after he died. Things were difficult. I was dropping out of school.
Israel is facing growing international condemnation over the killing of 7 men and women delivering humanitarian assistance in Gaza on Monday night. The aid workers killed were from the World Central Kitchen, which has now suspended its operations in Gaza. In a statement, Israel's army chief, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, called the incident a grave mistake, blaming a misidentification. He also insisted a full investigation would be carried out.
An independent body will investigate the incident thoroughly. We will complete it in the next coming days. We will learn from the conclusions and implement them immediately. We will share in full transparency the findings of the investigation with the World Central Kitchen and other international relevant organizations.
Hiba Tibi is from Care International. She says agencies are used to uncertainty, but the escalating situation may push more to suspend their operations.
Now it is again confirmed that there is nothing safe in Gaza, unfortunately. Already it's very dangerous for the teams on the ground to do what they want to do, the mandate that they are mandated to do to help the people. And I'm telling you, in the future, you will see again World Central Kitchen workers going back to help the people in Gaza. But in the future, I cannot guarantee what will be the situation.
Israel promised an independent investigation after the UK, US, Canada, Australia and Poland lost nationals in the attack. There have been calls for the US and the UK to stop selling weapons to Israel. But the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron has said he welcomes Israel's promise to investigate the strike and do more to support aid deliveries.
We've been promised these things before and this really needs to happen, including longer opening times at the vital crossing points. But of course the extra aid won't work unless there is proper deconfliction, unless aid can be taken around Gaza and we avoid the dreadful incidents like we've seen in the last couple of days. That is vital and Britain will be watching very closely to make sure that that happens.
I spoke earlier to our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell, who's in Jerusalem.
We're seeing a lot more pressure now on Israel to do something to protect aid workers, to put better systems in place so that they can coordinate with the Israeli military, so that they can work more effectively and safely. In general, Israel's been blaming poor communications between the World Central Kitchen team and its troops on the ground. I mean, it remains to be seen if there will be improvements now to humanitarian operations. They're talking about some plans such as setting up a new war room jointly operated by the Israeli military and aid organisations to coordinate things going on the ground.
But humanitarian organisations are pulling out, and understandably so, and this at a time when there is a desperate humanitarian crisis. What is going to happen? How is food going to reach people?
Yeah, I mean, this is really just an awful situation, because already we've had for weeks now international outcry about how there's just a trickle of aid getting into Gaza because of Israeli controls, Israel denying that it limits things, even questioning the basis of UN reports saying that there is a famine looming in Gaza. Now, because this issue about the safety of aid workers has really come to the fore, that's limiting assistance, making them question what they ask their staff to do on the ground even more. And, you know, there's just been real repercussions of that. We've been hearing from just ordinary people in Rafah, in the south of the Gaza Strip, that had been looking to these kitchens, which World Central Kitchen had set up to feed people for their daily meals, for some form of sustenance. They said they were feeding about 350,000 people a day. Now those Gazans are saying, how do they feed their children?
How are Israeli citizens responding to this attack?
This has been followed. There's been a lot of interest in exactly how this could have happened. It's been picked over from that point of view. But I think most Israelis accept that this was a mistake. There's still broad support for the war that's taking place. There hasn't been a huge amount of coverage in the Israeli media about the circumstances which are leading to the UN warning about famine approaching in Gaza. And so right now, just looking at the news, this has sort of dropped down to the bottom of the news bulletins in Israel this morning.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. To Taiwan now, where rescue efforts are taking place after a powerful earthquake struck off its east coast. Taiwan's National Fire Agency said at least 700 people have been injured, while 77 people remain trapped. Officials say so far 9 people are known to have died. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes was in the capital, Taipei, when the earthquake struck.
The shaking was intense and prolonged. Buildings across the city swayed violently. Cupboards were emptied, furniture toppled. No one in the Taiwanese capital has experienced anything like this in a quarter of a century. Many young people have never felt shaking on this scale. On the east coast in the city of Hualien, the shaking was much stronger and the damage much more severe. People on their way to work watched in fear and awe as a partially collapsed building was left leaning at a precarious angle. But it is the landslides that have unleashed the greatest terror. The east coast of Taiwan is a rugged landscape of high mountains and deep valleys. The quake triggered hundreds of landslides that came roaring down into the valleys below. This is where most of the more than 700 injuries must have happened. People would have had little warning and nowhere to escape. Taiwan has done much to strengthen its buildings and infrastructure since another huge quake killed more than 2,000 people back in 1999. This time, few buildings have been brought down and the death toll is so far mercifully small. But there is little that can be done to stop a mountain from falling into the valley below.
A tsunami warning has been declared for nearby Japanese islands in the southern prefecture of Okinawa, but has now been lifted. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil is in Tokyo and told me people are still being warned to be on high alert.
It's been quite a tense day here in Japan, actually, even though the tsunami warning has been lifted, because quite concerning that for the first time in more than a decade, the meteorological agency has issued a tsunami warning for the coastal areas in the Okinawa prefecture in the southwest, triggered, of course, by that very strong earthquake in Taiwan. Some of these islands in Okinawa are very, very close to Taiwan. Yonaguni Island, for example, which was hit by a 30-centimeter wave, not the 3-meter wave that was expected, is very close to Taiwan, that on a clear day, in some of these areas, in some areas in Yonaguni Island, you can see the Taiwanese coast. Earlier, we've also heard of alarms sounding repeatedly in different parts of Okinawa. Some residents described how scared they were that their phones as well. Alarms rang on their fours quite loudly. Yes, the authorities may have lifted the initial tsunami warning, but given how big the earthquake is in Taiwan, given how fluid the situation is as well, the meteorological agency is warning residents of possible tidal change, but also possible aftershocks.
And given the history, tsunami warnings for many people in Japan, the stuff of nightmares.
It is the stuff of nightmares. Remember that in the very beginning of this year, a very powerful earthquake, a 7.8 magnitude, hit central Japan and caused a great deal of damage and fatalities. One of the residents that was speaking to the Kyoto News Agency actually said there have been many warnings and there have been earthquakes quite a lot this year that I'm actually scared. But of course, the biggest and most traumatic memory in recent memory here in Japan is the earthquake of 2011, that 9.0 magnitude earthquake tsunami that led to the leak in Fukushima. And so people in Japan are quite alarmed, even though they're used to so many earthquakes, even though they're used to these shakes that happen almost on a daily basis because of how many earthquakes happen here. I think the magnitude of the alert and the repeated alarms have actually scared a lot of people until they were lifted. But people are still told to remain on high alert.
Shaima Khalil, and before her, we heard from Rupert Wingfield Hayes. The Constitutional Court in Uganda has refused to strike down a draconian anti-gay law, although the judges said parts of it violated constitutional rights. The law has been condemned internationally. Barbara Plett-Usher reports.
The law is one of the toughest in the world. It imposes life imprisonment for consensual same-sex relations and the death penalty for acts that it describes as aggravated homosexuality. Legal and human rights activists had argued that it violates fundamental rights guaranteed by Uganda's constitution. The court partly agreed. It refused to strike down the law, but it did nullify some sections that criminalize behavior, such as allowing gay sex to happen in one's property, failing to report acts of homosexuality, and giving someone a terminal illness through gay sex.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Pope Francis has given a unique insight into the manoeuvrings that led to the election of his predecessor, Pope Benedict. The revelations come in excerpts from a forthcoming book based on a Spanish journalist's interviews with the Pope. Mark Duff reports.
The election of the new head of the Roman Catholic Church is synonymous with secrecy. The conclave, as it's known, takes place behind locked doors in the Sistine Chapel in the heart of Vatican City. Its participants, the most senior bishops of the church, its cardinals, are sworn to keep their discussions secret in perpetuity. In excerpts from a forthcoming book, though, Francis gives that idea short shrift. Cardinals may be sworn to keep quiet, he says, but popes are allowed to tell. And the tale he has to tell is intriguing, one of Byzantine machinations surrounding the election of his predecessor, Benedict, in 2005. Francis says he was used as a stalking horse by cardinals trying to block the election of the then cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the future Benedict, a man who was controversial in his own right for his socially and doctrinally conservative views. Francis, then Archbishop Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Buenos Aires, was having none of it. He told the plotters that he wouldn't serve as Pope if elected under such circumstances. And after that, he says, it was only a matter of time before a puff of white smoke emerged from the Sistine Chapel, the traditional signal for the election of a new pope, Benedict XVI.
Mark Duff. Police in France are facing growing scrutiny over allegations of violence which have provoked nationwide protests. We've reported on some of those incidents, but we seldom look at the issue from the side of the police themselves. There are concerns about a high suicide rate among officers and about the impact on their families. Our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding is the first foreign journalist allowed to visit an orphanage for the children of French police.
17-year-old Eleanor is just back from school. In the kitchen, 10-year-old Elio has been helping to make lunch. So far, so very ordinary. But these domestic scenes are unfolding in a unique space on the south coast of France, an orphanage for the children of French police officers. Eleanor arrived here in Agde 4 years ago after her father had taken his own life. He'd been one of the first police to respond to this incident. a devastating Islamist attack at the Bataclan Concert Hall in Paris in 2015. Afterwards, he'd struggled to live with the horrors he'd seen.
My dad was my hero, but he never spoke about his job. I came here a month after he died. Things were difficult. I was dropping out of school.
At the orphanage, Eleanor found others wrestling with the same grief. And she found comfort living with children of very different ages.
I take care of the younger kids. They're like brothers and sisters to me. They're going through the same things I did, but being small, they don't understand as much.
These have been hard years for French police. A 2016 funeral here for a married couple, both serving officers, killed by an Islamist militant. And relentless allegations of police brutality. These nationwide riots last year, only the latest in a string of angry public responses. Hervé Poyer is president of Orfeo Police, the charity that runs the orphanages and which helps some 3,000 children.
These days, it's not always easy to be the child of a police officer, but we need to stick together. And that means that if a policeman dies, we must continue to look after the children.
That help takes many forms. Alexander lost his father in a police rescue accident. But at the age of 18, he's now decided he wants the same career. At a local gym in central France, another branch of the orphanage is helping him train for the police entrance exams. Alexander says, I want to serve, to protect people. My father taught me the value of discipline and hard work. An evening game of football. This system, funded by public donations and supported by the police, is only and exclusively for the families of police officers. But it is a powerful example of how shared grief can lead to shared healing.
Andrew Harding with that report. Still to come in the Global News podcast. Moon residents.
At the tone, 20 hours, 48 minutes. Coordinated Universal Time.
Forget Greenwich Mean Time. You will soon have Coordinated Lunar Time. A new economic war for critical minerals has begun, and a new book has been described as an urgent dispatch from the front line. To build electric vehicles, solar panels, cell phones and millions of other devices means the world must dig more mines to extract lithium, copper and other vital building blocks. But the mines are deeply unpopular, even as they have a role to play in fighting climate change. Ernest Schrader is the author of a new book, The War Below Lithium, Copper and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. He's been telling Justin Webb that we all face difficult decisions.
I would say that the tough choices involve, okay, are there some places that are too special to mine? And if we are going to mine in some places, what are the standards by which we would allow mining? And what does that actually look like when we engage with host communities and make sure that their desires and their wishes are respected, especially when it comes to indigenous lands that have not always historically been treated well? So right now, especially in Western countries, there's a whole host of different rules that are confusing for not only mining companies, but conservation groups and environmentalists that may oppose them. But still, the demand for these critical minerals are rising across the globe. So therein lies sort of the tension right now. Therein lies the choices. So if we're going to have this energy transition, we have to be thinking about where we actually want to produce them. And that's the choice. That's the tension.
Is it also a case of us having to think about whether we can find some other way of powering ourselves in the future that doesn't involve doing this? Because I wonder if that's what some people, at least listening to this, are thinking. They're just going from taking one thing out of the ground, oil, into taking another thing or another set of things. Just isn't the answers, isn't the long-term answer for the planet.
Sure. I do have a chapter in the book that looks at recycling, because one of the main questions I got the more I reported out this book was, do we really need more mines? Can't we just recycle our way to this green energy future? And the simple answer is right now, no. Like when we look at the demand projections to convert just transportation from a fossil fuel dependent transportation sector to one that's entirely dependent on critical minerals would require gargantuan increases in the supply of cobalt, copper, lithium, nickel, and all these other critical minerals. So just this one talking point, Justin, I mean, all of the copper that's been mined throughout humanity up into this year right now, we're going to have to mine that same volume of copper out to 2050 just to hit the goals of the Paris Climate Accords. And that's just for copper. I think at some point we will hit what's called a circular economy, where we're able to recycle old batteries to get the metals we need for future batteries. But it's going to take a lot more mining to actually get to that point. I mean, we're talking right now through microphones that are connected by copper wiring, and that copper had to come from somewhere. I have a chapter in the book that talks about leaf blowers, and the chapter draws on my own personal experience a few years ago when I was deciding whether or not to get a lawnmower for my house. And so because I was writing this book, I decided, okay, well, I should get an electric lawnmower. And then I had a friend say, well, if you get a leaf blower, you should not get one powered by fossil fuels because they're horrible for the environment. And I did my homework, and indeed, they are pretty horrible for the environment. So I got an electric leaf blower, and that led me down this big rabbit hole of, okay, where do the critical minerals in this leaf blower come from? Do the supplies of nickel come from Indonesia, where rainforests have been dug up in order to supply nickel? And do the supplies of cobalt come from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where sometimes children as young as 7 can be part of the supply chain? If we can't actually prove the provenance of them, then that sort of lays bare how we just don't really know how all of these electronic gadgets and gizmos we use every single day are actually built. We as consumers across the world should pay more attention to these supply chains and actually recognize that our everyday purchasing power has a direct effect on how these materials are mined. And so that would require some tough choices. Like, if we don't like children mining cobalt out of the Congo, which I think as a base case, we can say nobody likes that. Well, then are we willing to allow more cobalt mining in areas that we might consider pristine?
Ernest Shader speaking to Justin Webb. In Thailand, the Constitutional Court has accepted a case which seeks to dissolve the main opposition Move Forward Party. The petition was filed by the Election Commission over the party's manifesto promise to reform the harsh Les Majestés law, which criminalises any negative comment about the monarchy. Jonathan Head is in Bangkok and told me about the impact it will have on the Move Forward Party.
It is a blow, although it's probably one of the most widely anticipated moves in Thailand. Everyone knew this was going to happen, and it's not new. The Constitutional Court has done this many times before against parties and politicians who have policies or approaches to government that are deemed too radical or too threatening to the status quo. This pretext, the proposal by the party that the Les Majestés law, they weren't proposing abolishing it. They would just say it should be rather less harsh and a little less easy to invoke. That has been judged sufficient to merit dissolving it, despite the tremendous mandate they got from their election performance last year.
So what will be the consequences for the party if the court rules against it?
When the party's dissolved, it also results in its top leadership suffering political sanctions. It's usually a ban from politics for quite long periods, usually 10 years or longer, and could possibly result in some criminal penalties or criminal cases being filed against them. For the rest of the party and its elected MPs, they have the option to move to a different party. And because party dissolutions are such a normal part of Thailand's political culture, any party that thinks this is going to happen usually prepares and registers another party, a sort of sleeper party, to act as an alternative. Indeed, Move Forward itself is an alternative party to its predecessor, Future Forward, which did very well in a previous election and was also banned and dissolved for the same reason. However, when Future Forward was dissolved in 2020, that not only sparked off the biggest political protest Thailand has seen in a long time, with unprecedented public calls for reforms of the monarchy, but also appears to have led to its successor party, Move Forward, actually performing better. So it's quite possible that even though Move Forward now gets dissolved, whatever successor party follows it, still wearing this reformist mantle, may do even better at the next election. And I think it's beginning to dawn on those who rely on the courts to police parties that this policy doesn't work. that when you disqualify parties, they can emerge stronger at the end of it, and that may well happen in Move Forward's case. The party is playing a long game. It's young, its key members are young, its appeal is still very strong in Thailand, and I think their view will be simply to keep bashing away, telling Thai people it is the only party fully in favour of real changes in the country, and there is an appetite for that change here. They will hold on in the hope that the next election, which is in just 3 years' time, they will have a chance to show that the public still supports them.
Jonathan Head. Police in central India say at least 13 Maoist rebels have been killed and a dozen wounded in a clash weeks ahead of the general election in the state of Chhattisgarh. The authorities say the gunfight took place in the district of Bijapur. It takes the number of Maoists killed this year in India's long-running conflict to 50. I asked our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan in Delhi what sparked the latest clash.
Officials are saying that they were conducting anti-insurgency operations ahead of the elections starting on the 19th of April in this particular area. And this attack, they say they've also recovered a huge cache of weapons, including a light machine gun. This also shows that how volatile the situation in these areas, even though the Maoist insurgency, the intensity has come down in recent years.
Ambarasan, what are the insurgents fighting for here?
This Maoist insurgency, it started in the 1960s. They were also called as Naxalites, and they say they're the fighting for the rights of the indigenous communities, the rural poor and the peasants. And what they say is that big corporations, they come to these mineral-rich regions of Chhattisgarh state, Jharkhand, and they take these minerals, build a dam, displace people, and these indigenous communities do not get anything in return. So they are, what they say is they are waging a war against the Indian state, and they have been asking the government to focus on development. The Indian authorities for decades, for various governments, not only this current government, have been putting more soldiers and more police forces there. In the last one decade or so, the intensity has come down, mainly because people are also migrating for better opportunities from these areas. But some of these hardcore Maoist rebels still there, and that is why once in a while this kind of fighting happens.
Anbarasan Etirajan with that report. British police say three suspects wanted in connection with the stabbing of an Iranian journalist in London left the UK within hours of the attack. 36-year-old Puria Zerati was stabbed outside his home on Friday afternoon. He's now been discharged from hospital. We heard more from Tom Simons.
What they've established is that the victim was approached, and that's Puria Zerati, a prominent presenter at Iran International, which has been targeted before for political reasons. They've established that he was approached by two men in a residential street in Wimbledon. He was then attacked with a knife. The suspects were driven away from the scene in a vehicle, a blue Mazda 3, driven by a third person. And that was found abandoned a few miles away in the New Malden area. And then police appear to have tracked these three suspects to Heathrow Airport, where, as we said, they left the UK. That's within a few hours of the attack. Now, another key question is what the explanation for this attack is. The Met is not saying. It says it actually doesn't know at this stage and is in pursuing all lines of inquiry and keeping an open mind on any potential motivation for the attack. But you can see from the narrative that I've just set out there that this did look to have been quite well planned. And so I think high up in the police's minds will be the possibility of some sort of an attack to terrorise the journalists. I have asked the Metropolitan Police where these two have gone to, and also which international partners. The Met says it's liaising with international policing partners. The police are not saying at the moment. They've clearly made quite a lot of progress in this investigation, no doubt using CCTV, tracking people across London in the ways that they can these days. But as to this more political aspect of the investigation, currently they are not saying.
Tom Simons. Let's end with an old BBC World Service joke. It's 9 o'clock Greenwich. Meantime, here is the news. Well, today's news is that we can update that to moon time, not Greenwich though, and strictly speaking, lunar rather than moon. And that's because the US government has asked the space agency NASA to work with international agencies and devise a new way of keeping track of time on the moon. Stephanie Zacherson has the details.
At the tone, 20 hours, 48 minutes, coordinated universal time.
If you're living down here on Earth with the rest of us, the time where you are is tied to Coordinated Universal Time, or UTC. But in space, time's a bit different. The moon's gravity is different to Earth, and the days are much longer. When astronauts are on a mission, they have to adapt to a lot of different time zones depending on which country's flag they've got embroidered on their suit. Former astronaut Mike Massimino told NBC it can get confusing.
On the space station, because it was controlled with control centers around the world, because of that, they decided to have one time zone that would be for the space station, and that is universal time.
As more and more countries and private companies are looking to explore space, and with dozens of moon missions planned for the coming decade, agencies have raised the need for an international standard in how to tell time on and around the lunar surface. NASA has now been asked by the White House to set a lunar time standard. In a memo sent to the agency, it says that it's imperative for the safety and accuracy of missions. The US is planning to return humans to the moon and establish a scientific lunar base that could help set the stage for future missions to Mars. The European Space Agency last year also said this new era of space exploration would require its own time zone, saying that there needs to be a precise way to tell the exact time to ensure safe navigation on the moon. Otherwise, it warned, docking spacecraft could tumble into each other, or astronauts might get lost on the lunar surface. And with multiple missions coming up, they'd need to communicate together and fix their positions independently from the Earth.
Stephanie Zacherson. And that's all from us for now. But there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Philip Bull. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.